today I talked to former Governor Rod Blagojevich. This guy, I think, has been totally screwed by the federal government. The case against him, allegedly selling the Senate seat held by Barack Obama when he was governor. The allegation was he essentially gave it to somebody for his own personal gain. I've looked into it. It's nonsense. It's complicated, but I think the guy was railroaded. You can read about it. We talk about it a little bit here. The most noteworthy thing, well, recently for the former governor is he was granted a sentence commutation by the president of the United States a few months ago. And I remember the night he got out of jail, and it was awesome. I felt great for him. He was sentenced to 14 years in jail, which is a ludicrously strong sentence. I think he's going to get all of these charges ultimately overturned. I don't think he wants a pardon. I think he wants to prove his establish his innocence through the appeals process, and I bet he will. We talk a lot about his political career. We talk a lot about his very interesting first encounter and second encounter with Donald Trump back when he was governor, actually soon to be governor and then governor. A chance encounter on an elevator changed his life. Had no way of telling it at the time, but had he not been, well, Governor Blagojevich is not a snob, and had he been a snob, he'd still be in jail. Everything changed. Didn't realize it at the time, but everything would change due to that chance encounter with Donald Trump. He's a great guy, and I think he's got a big future ahead of him. My conversation with Rod Blagojevich. Hey, Governor, I really appreciate it. And right off the bat, Blagojevich is quite a name. What kind of name is that?
It's a Serbian name. My father was an immigrant from Yugoslavia. He fought in the Yugoslavian Royal Army on the side of the Allies. And then when the Nazis invaded in the spring of 1941, my dad, like thousands of other soldiers and officers in the Yugoslavian Army, they were defeated, and so they were taken prisoner. So he spent 4 years in the Nazi prisoner of war camp. And then after that, because Yugoslavia turned communist, he didn't want to go back to a communist country after fighting fascism. He waited in a refugee camp for three more years until in 1948, the United States Congress, that one day his youngest son would become a member of, and that's me, passed a law called the Displaced Persons Act, which allowed millions, my father and millions of others like him with these long and hard to pronounce last names, a chance to come to America and, you know, chase opportunity, freedom, and maybe reach for the American dream. And so that's my dad's story. And he like your father, I know you're so proud of your dad. You know, my dad was a factory worker. You know, he was a kind of a, you know, had a real promising career back in the old country until the world was turned upside down and World War II came. But then for him and so many others like him who, after that war, had to relocate and find new homes and start their lives all over again, brand new beginning for him. He did it with no complaints. When he came here, he didn't speak a word of English, didn't have a penny in his pocket, got a job at the Goodyear factory in the Chicagoland area, and then became a steel worker and worked real hard. You know, things were looking good for him, and you know, I was on a very high mountain, brought low to a very deep valley, and I'm beginning my life again. And, you know, there are a lot of figures in history that really give me inspiration, but maybe I would say the greatest inspiration and the greatest example of building a new life would be my father. And I saw how he did it. And, you know, his ship never came in. My dad and my mom never got a chance to own their own home, but, you know, they put it all into their kids. And that's the story that's so typically American, that you can come from a faraway place and start a whole new life here in this land of opportunity. And if it's not there for you, it could be there for your children. And you know, that was the embodiment of the American dream, my life. And the sacrifices that my parents did to provide me with those opportunities are, you know, they're always with me, and they're frankly inspirational.
That's incredible. By the way, you have an older brother?
I do. My older brother, Robert, he lives in Nashville, Tennessee.
And he was in the Army?
He was in the Army. He's a retired colonel from the United States Army. 6 years of active service, and and then I think another 14 years in the reserves. And he's been very successful. He's in the real estate business down in the South, in the mid-South. And I mean, my brother, God bless him, has lived the American dream.
You know, by the way, you grew up speaking Serbian. I mean, in the household, was that the primary language, secondary language? You speak Serbian to some degree.
Yes.
How did that happen?
We spoke Serbian with my father because he was from the old country. Now, we were very fortunate in that my mother was American born. And so with her, it was English. And, you know, you look at my last name being what it is, difficult to say. Had my dad had his druthers, my first name would have been as hard to pronounce as my last name. And I don't think I'd have ever been elected to anything, much less governor of Illinois. But my mother was American born, and she recognized that my brother and I were being raised in the United States. And she was very determined to make sure that we grew up like all the other kids in the neighborhood, and that, while we, had our roots were in the culture from the old country that my dad was very much a part of, we were, kind of typical kids growing up in the United States. We loved baseball and sports and, the things kids do in America growing up. My dad, if he had his brothers, I think he would have had us, dancing the old folklore dances from the old country, those kinds of things, which we had to do a little bit of when we were being raised in the church and in the church community. But for the most part, we had kind of like that typical American lifestyle. And that was my mother. I think we would have been maybe too Eurocentric had my dad had his way completely.
You know, I want to jump ahead, actually. Here you are in Congress. You're elected, 96, right?
Yes.
96.
Yes, that's right.
You're a new member of Congress. You speak Serbian. You know the issues very well at that point. We were essentially at war. I know nothing. I remember being totally confused by it while it was happening, probably like most members of Congress. But you actually knew the issues, and you decided, maybe a little presumptuous on your part, but I admire it. You called the White House. You sought out the National Security Advisor because you might be able to help. And I think kind of this odyssey that you go on for the next couple of weeks is very telling in a lot of different ways. But so what happens when you put a call into the National Security Advisor, kind of announcing yourself as somebody who could help out with the situation in Serbia?
Well, to begin with, I was against the war. I thought that was wrong, that the United States would determine for a sovereign country what its boundaries should be when there was a major treaty that was enacted back in 1919 after World War I that created this country, Yugoslavia. Now, it was breaking up because of the breakup of communism and then what was going on in the Balkans in the early 1990s. But the United States, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and the NATO allies decided that they were going to pretty much break up a portion of what was left of Yugoslavia and force the Yugoslavian government to accept the partition that they thought was appropriate. And that would be very comparable to, example, the United Nations saying that, if the U.S. or Texas doesn't go back to Mexico, they're going to gang up on the United States and start bombing us. So I was against that war, and I spoke against it. I was one of only, I think, 15 Democrats to oppose it. We spoke on the House floor on a Wednesday evening, and then the next day the bombing began. I warned that if we start bombing that country, Milosevic, who was the Yugoslavian president, had already shown a real violent tendency in Bosnia and in Croatia and in other places as the former Yugoslavia was breaking up, and that ethnic cleansing, which is so much a part of what the wars in Europe have always been, was very likely going to ensue. And that if we bombed him, we were going to provoke him because he had 40,000 troops on the border of Kosovo. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And then all of the suffering that occurred for the innocent civilians in Kosovo when Milosevic's forces did that systemic ethnic cleansing. And once that happens, then, of course, I don't see how the world community could stand by and allow it to happen. At that point, there was a vote later on in the Congress, a couple of weeks later, because incidentally, Greg, what they do is what Clinton did was they decided to begin the bombing when Congress adjourned for 2 weeks for the Easter break. And for Passover and for the Passover holiday. So while the Congress was out of town, they felt that was probably the most opportune time to begin the bombing and start a war. I think they expected there was going to be a quick resolution, that Milosevic was going to back down, that he was bluffing about the ethnic cleansing, and that they would submit to what was that called the Rambouillet Agreement, that had reached this decision to break up what was left of Yugoslavia and give Kosovo the opportunity to basically secede. So anyway, the war begins, and I came home that weekend, and you know, I'm a United States congressman. I'm an American citizen. This is my country, and now we're at war with the country my father came from. I was warned against the war. I argued against it, but once the war began, I was the deciding vote in the House to fund that war. I felt like once our forces were engaged, I had to support the military and our soldiers and give them the tools they needed to win. And so at that point, you know, even though I didn't like the war, my country's now at war, and so it's time to back my country and do what I could as a member of Congress to support it, which I did. Well, what happened was early on in, during the war, three United States soldiers were taken prisoner. They were caught crossing the border into Serbia, and I think inadvertently, Sergeant Stone, Specialist Gonzalez, and Specialist Ramirez. Stone was from Michigan, Gonzalez was from Texas, and Ramirez was from Los Angeles.
So, but
and
the,
so these
the,
guys got.
The, yeah. I can just jump in. The amazing thing to me, though, is you have all of this knowledge back at the time. You're a brand new congressman. You're not a foreign affairs specialist. At least you're not credentialed as such. You didn't run
right
on these issues in Chicago. This was
right
not the burning issue in Chicago, but you arrive with this kind of innate knowledge of the situation, common sense, life experience. It seems to me like you know and you knew a lot more than the specialists at the State Department. And here you are as a freshman kind of outlining and voicing your concerns, and all of those things would ultimately happen, and you engage somebody, and it's totally appropriate for you to do so, the National Security Advisor to the President. You are a sitting congressman. It's not an it's not an unreasonable phone call. And that, what happens to that call? I mean, do they get back to you? Do they say, wait a second, yeah, this is a guy we should talk to? What happens after that?
Well, that's interesting. So I came home after that war began for the two-week break, and then the soldiers were taken prisoner. And because my father came from that country and I was the only Serbian-American member of Congress, I felt like perhaps maybe I could be helpful, particularly after I was contacted by someone who purported to be in that Yugoslavian government, who had, was in Milosevic's cabinet. And at first I was a little suspicious of this guy. He's Serbian, he speaks the language, and speaking it to me. He was in my office in Congress in the Cannon office building. But then through contacts in the Serbian community in Chicago, which is in the Serbian community in America, this Chicago has a respectable amount of Serbs who live here, but we're a very small group when it comes to the larger breakup of the ethnic groups in Chicago, which is such a big city and such an ethnic city. But anyway, this guy was legit. And so I'm actually on a Saturday evening, I'm watching CNN, and, you know, the war was the big news, and they were covering it 24/7. All the Fox News was.
Let me just—it's a small point, but like Sandy Berger didn't call you back, and quite frankly, that just kind of frustrated me. That here's a guy who knows the situation, and you've got these contacts. Things are happening. You might be able to help. And in Washington, that it's not always about that. It's just not always on the merits. It's there are a lot of other considerations that people have. But you reached out to Podesta, and he was a bit more. Podesta was the chief of staff at the time, and I think he was a bit more accommodating. He was willing to listen, right?
Yes. What happened was eventually Axelrod and I discussed, you know, what role I could play, and I told him that I had been contacted by that guy that was in the Serbian government, and that he was legitimate. And Axelrod suggested that perhaps you might be able to try to bring those guys home, the three soldiers, that you can play a role doing that. And he came up with the idea, and he thought, well, you're just a freshman or a second-year congressman, and you're gonna be in a real difficult position. There's not enough gravitas to your position. We need to figure out a way where we can have a little more power behind the role I'd like to play, because I want to see what I can do to bring those boys home. First, I called Sandy Berger because that seemed to be the proper channels He never called me back. And then I went to Ike Skelton, who was one of the leading ranking Democrats in the House Armed Services Committee. I was a member of that committee, and Ike, old school guy from Missouri, good guy. He called Podesta, and Podesta then called me back. And Podesta's from Chicago, so there was a connection. I offered my services and said that I speak the language. I think I can help maybe negotiate or play whatever role to try to bring those guys home, that the people in the Yugoslavian government had actually reached out to me. And the guy that two of them actually, it turned out two did, and that they were real, and that they were willing to actually entertain the thought that perhaps somebody like me can come there to Serbia and try to negotiate with Milosevic the return of our soldiers. Podesta was very polite, but there was no follow-up. And so days went by, weeks went by, and it became apparent to me, frankly, that, you know, I hate to sound cynical, but knowing the business as I do, and I certainly know it better now than I did even then when I was basically in my early years in politics, I don't think they wanted those guys home. I think, frankly, the politics, the international politics was such, and the domestic politics for Clinton, to keep the American people engaged in support of a war that many people had questions about. Granted, most people didn't understand the issues, but there was something that didn't seem right, that suddenly the big United States with all the powerful NATO allies are starting to bomb this small country over Kosovo. How is that in the American national interest? And I think they were afraid that if those soldiers came home, that might undermine the public support for the war. And to this day, I very much believe that was their thinking. And if they had their druthers, I don't think they wanted us to bring those guys home. Now, what helped their politics here was that Milosevic was such a brutal dictator that he, you know, went in and did what he did and ethnically cleansed innocent ethnic Kosovars. And that, of course, created the uproar across the world, understandably so. But had Milosevic not misplayed his cards that way, if the Serbs had basically just kind of did like a Muhammad Ali version of rope-a-dope and, you know, took the bombing and got their asses kicked a little bit, and now that I have a chance to maybe help soldiers come home, I'm running into a cynical situation where the Clinton administration says all the right things, but they don't, in reality, they don't want this to happen. And they were very difficult in terms of getting them to agree to allow us to go. I could not go by myself. The State Department wouldn't give approval. And so the idea that Axel came up with was, see if you might be able to engage Reverend Jesse Jackson.
This was like a thing that he did. He was good at this kind of thing. I mean, he did it before in Lebanon. He was something of a, I guess he was a pest in a weird way for the powers that be, because he generated a lot of publicity. But look, I want to just jump in. Would you consider, given your knowledge, I think my sense is you're kind of looking for what's next in your life professionally, out of the box idea, could you be the ambassador to Kosovo, which I believe is a country? Is that something you're qualified to do? Is that something that you would like to do? And is that totally crazy?
You know, I haven't thought of in view of, you know, where I just came back from, but, you know, I'm open to suggestions. I mean, if there's a chance to be able to play a role and make my country a better place, the United States of America, I mean, I have an open mind. Now, let me say this. Do I believe I'm qualified to be like an ambassador to a country like Serbia or, for example, Kosovo? Absolutely. Now, why do I say that? Well, I mean, George W. Bush appointed like a car salesman from Texas to be the ambassador to the Court of St. James in England because this guy was a big fundraiser for him. And I've known ambassadors. I'm not diminishing them, but their credentials are, you know, they're fine, but they're not necessarily such that would make me feel like I wasn't qualified either. So no, I think I could. I do believe I can do that. You know, after all, you know, I was the governor of the fifth largest state in America, and I really believe I was a great governor for the people. And if I could be a great governor in a big state like Illinois, I think I could be a great ambassador in a small country like Serbia or Kosovo. Not that I'm seeking that.
It's not just, that you're seeking that question, it, but I know, and it's a little bit of an off-the-wall question. And also, I mean, a big, I guess the ultimate credential for an ambassador is a relationship with the leader of whatever country they're serving. And on that, How well do you know President Trump? Obviously, you had interactions on The Celebrity Apprentice, but how would you characterize your friendship? I know he did something magnificent for you, and I'd like to talk about that. But first, how often do you see him? Do you talk to him? Did he, before he became president, just how would you characterize your relationship?
Oh, I know President Trump a little bit from the Celebrity Apprentice program. And before that, I met him. I can tell you exactly. I met him the first time in October of 2002 in your hometown, New York City, in George Steinbrenner's owner's box. During a Yankees Anaheim Angels playoff game, Steinbrenner was hosting a fundraiser for me, and I looked to be well on my way to winning. I'm going to be the first Democratic governor elected in Illinois in 26 years. The polling was good, and our campaign was going well. And so, at that point, you know, in politics, Greg, when you look like you're going to win, all of a sudden, people you don't know they call you and they want to do fundraisers for you. And I got to know George Steinbrenner a little bit through a business partner of his in Illinois a little before that. What a great guy he was. God bless him. And I, you know, pray that he's in heaven. I know he is, and he's doing well up there. But what a great guy and a fascinating guy and a great baseball fan. And I know a lot about baseball. So, frankly, a lot more about baseball than I do about the state budget. I got to know him a little bit. So he hosted a fundraiser for me at Yankee Stadium, and it was great. And you know, one moment into the, you know, as the fundraiser was unfolding, this tall guy with a commanding presence, dressed in a nice, beautiful suit, walks in, accompanied by a little shorter guy, substantially shorter, also well-dressed in a suit. And it was Regis Philbin accompanying Donald Trump as guests to Steinbrenner's fundraiser for me. And, you know, then not President Donald Trump, was introduced to me and was very nice and friendly. So that was the first time I saw him. The second time I saw him was a year later. I'm now the governor of Illinois, and it's December of 2003. And at that point, I was viewed as a sort of like the new face from the Midwest. I was 2 years ahead of Obama. And there was talk about looking for a Democratic alternative to Hillary Clinton from the so-called heartland of America. This is how Axelrod used to phrase it. And here again, because, you know, my stock was pretty high. We were raising a lot of campaign money in places that we didn't before, like Hollywood and in New York, where big Democratic donors are. And they were reaching out to us. It was really interesting. And so I was on a trip doing that. And the guy that had hosted me had an interest in a heavyweight prize fighter, and he was fighting Klitschko, who was in the restaurant before the fights, and we went to be respectful and watch his fighter fight with Klitschko. And so I was there. It didn't take long. His fighter got his ass kicked. You can see at the moment he got in the ring, he was really out of shape. Klitschko knocked him out, I think, in the second round. And anyways, we finished. Now I'm the governor. I've got all the security around me, state police detail. And when I would travel then, they'd get out in front of me, you know, to make arrangements on, you know, how you get in and out of places. And so they had commandeered a freight elevator. And this is really interesting, Greg, because I've often thought about this. And they were holding this freight elevator open and waiting for me to, you know, kind of leave the arena and make our exit with my host and a guy from our campaign. And so as we get there, they're holding it. I'm standing on the side of the freight elevator was Donald Trump and this strikingly beautiful tall woman with this real dark black hair, clearly an international model, right? And of course, I wasn't surprised that this is Donald Trump. And I remember, you know, admiring Donald Trump's date. I would learn years later when I was in prison, and I was all for him then. I was a Trumpocrat even before he did what he did for me. And here's this striking, beautiful woman. Her hair is not nearly as dark anymore. It's a lighter color. But I'm saying that's the woman that was with him at the freight elevator. It was Melania. And they were dating there then, I guess. Anyway, long story short, what happened was Donald Trump and Melania were in that freight elevator. The security guys asked them to step out that they were holding it for me. Now, can you imagine? I walk into the elevator and I immediately say, oh, please come in. right? And so Trump and Melania enter the elevator. Can you imagine if I was an arrogant snob and I didn't invite him into that elevator? I wouldn't be talking to you today. I'm haunted by the thought.
Well, you did the right thing. Obviously, you're a nice guy, you're a generous person, and you wouldn't be that guy. But that is amazing. And there are a lot of people who would throw their power around and, no, this is an exclusive temporary freight elevator for the governor. I love that. Hey, by the way, Melania, it's interesting. I was in the room in Trump Tower when he announced, when he came down the escalator. I was actually there. My TV station was only a block away. And when he's coming down the escalator, all I could look at and all I could think about was this woman in front of him. She was about two steps below him on the escalator. Like, who is that? It wasn't apparent that they were a couple, quite frankly, just the way they were standing. And, you know, it just, I could not believe in just like your reaction, like, who is, that's all I was thinking about. Well, history is being made right before our eyes. And I'm just wondering, who is that woman? So that is wild. And I wonder if he remembers that. Have you ever been able to have like a personal sit down chat in all of this, you know, from the very beginning, from the Yankee Stadium to now? Have you ever, you know, he's a guy on the move, as you know, and he talks fast,
right?
And I don't think he has a lot of patience for long drawn out conversations. Have you ever had a long kind of easy casual chat with him?
Well, how would you define long? Like how long? Like more than like 2 minutes?
You ever have dinner with him?
No. And on Celebrity Apprentice, when I had the chance to do that show, I had interaction with him off camera. And let me say this. He's a very nice man. If he likes you, he's extremely good to you. Now, I know he's really competitive, but, you know, there's a real loyalty to him is what I sensed having done that show with him. And I was fortunate enough where I think he liked me. I think he liked the fact that I was fighting back the way I was. And he said that on the air. And I mean, he fired me in a real nice way and is commending, telling me, you know, you got a lot of guts. I really admire you, you know, how you fight back against these people. You know, my prosecutors, who I believe I know are persecutors. And he was really complimentary, and, you know, before he ultimately pulled the trigger and fired me. By the way, he's the only president in American history, Greg, to have ever fired and freed the same guy. Not even Lincoln did that. Okay? And he was right on both counts.
That is totally wild.
Right, but he was really kind. If I could tell a quick little story, it was the last show. You know, they filmed it in October of 2009. And by the way, this is something I never watched these television shows, and I never watched Celebrity Apprentice. I didn't watch any reality shows. I was the governor, and I was busy being governor. And you know, if I relaxed or watched television, it was football. You know, the NFL, or you know, I'd watch baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. I would do that. But I wouldn't watch, you know, ordinary television shows. And I'd watch some news shows, but not much of a TV watcher. So now I'm, you know, they brought my life to ruin. Calamity came, and you know the story. And suddenly, I have no income, and because my wife was in a place where she was an executive director working for a homeless organization, she was doing great work, and she had a contract. They fired her because, when I was arrested, they terminated their contract with her because they were fearful of losing their state funding, and they breached a contract. We chose not to pursue the contract for obvious reasons. We don't want to be suing a homeless organization, but suddenly the two of us don't have any income, and we're not like the current governor. You know, we didn't inherit billions of dollars or millions of dollars or really any dollars. And so that income was important to my family and my wife. So two of us are now without income. But strangely, as I'm fighting back against my persecutors and I'm doing all these television shows, one of the shows I did was David Letterman. And, you know, he was making fun of my circumstances. But I think that led to an opportunity for my wife for me to actually be invited on a show called I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which was an NBC TV show. The prosecutors objected to me going to Costa Rica and they wouldn't give me my passport back. And the judge agreed. So I couldn't do it, but I was so notorious at the time, not in a good way, but publicly known, that they wanted my wife. And so she did it, and the American people liked her, and she did really well. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, I'm being offered things, Greg, that were they sort of fit into the typecast, how I was being typecast. Like, a, you know, when I was arrested, Madoff had his problems, and the two of us were like the biggest jerks in the world, right? The way we were being portrayed, I'm being accused of selling Obama's Senate seat, which incidentally I didn't. And the appellate court eventually ruled that was never a crime to begin with. It was routine political horse trading. But in the meantime, this was the big lie they told. And so when I'm fighting back, I've got this, I'm carrying this big lie with me. Churchill said, a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its, put its pants on. And, you know, I'm still to this day trying to put my pants on and get the stink off of that lie off of me. But so I'm getting some offers, strangely, from the entertainment world, which I had no connection with. And I was offered, for example, a six-figure job on an HBO show called The Bunny Ranch, which was a whorehouse. And they wanted me to be the greeter at this whorehouse. And, you know, even though I needed the income, I couldn't do that. And so I politely declined. I was invited to go out to a place in Santa Monica where they had this thing called the Game Show Network. And I was interested in that. I thought that was respectable enough. Maybe I could, before the trial, I could host some kind of a game show. And when I got there, they already had an idea of what they wanted me to do. And when they described the show, I'd be like this kind of roving guy who would kind of break into people's bedrooms when the husband's cheating on his wife, and we catch the guy in the middle of the act, and I've got the wife with me, and I stick a microphone in his face, right? And I said to the guy, look, I'm not comfortable doing that. That's just not something I'm interested in. I remember asking him, I was more interested in something like a, you know, you got a pretty girl, she spins a wheel, and I ask questions, trivia questions. You got anything like that? I'd be interested in that. And the guy said to me, well, we don't see you that way in that role. We think you're tailor-made for this. And I guess there is a show now. It's called Cheaters. I think they had me in mind for that spot, which I declined. Anyway, so now along the way, I'm invited to do Celebrity Apprentice, which is a respectable show. But I had never watched it. I was well aware of Donald Trump. I admired his tremendous success as a real estate developer. Had met him and liked him when I met him. Saw him at the elevator that day. And so we jumped at the chance to do that one because it was a way to earn some income and to, earn some income. And so that's how it happened. And then on the show, they filmed it in New York in March of 2010, the final episode. And I think it was at New York University before a live audience. And the final two contestants were squaring off. It was this rock star by the name of Bret Michaels. And a TV star named Holly Robinson Pete. The two of them were the final two. And the rest of us who had been fired were part of the program on the stage. And Trump would ask questions of us. And he would ask me a few questions. And during one of those periods, he asked me something. I think he asked a show of hands of my fellow contestants who thought I was guilty and who thought I wasn't. And my two daughters were in the audience with Patty, my wife. There were about 500 people, maybe more in the audience, maybe 1,000. And when I insisted on my innocence, again, I always slide that in because I'm always on message, right? There was a big uproar of laughter from the live audience. And I'm thick-skinned and I've been through all kinds of stuff, so I'm pretty good at handling it. Just like Trump is, because geez, what he goes through and what they do to him. Anyway, when the show was over, it just so happened that I was on another elevator story. I was on an elevator with my two daughters. Our little one, Annie, at the time was about 5 years old. She would have been 6 years old. And Amy, our older daughter, was 13, 12 going on 13. So they were little girls, and Patty, devoted wife, and me on the elevator. And lo and behold, Donald Trump walks in to take the elevator ride down. And I introduce him to my wife and my two daughters. We get off of the elevator. And he's so tall, you know, and my girls are just so little. And he kind of gets down to their eye level. There's no TV cameras there. There's no publicity. No one's even, I never mind wildest dreams do I think he's going to one day run for president. And he says real nice things to my daughters about their father, because he was sensitive to the fact that the audience that they were sitting in had sort of mockingly laughed at him. You see what I'm saying, Greg?
Sure.
It was a real kind thing. And, you know, I know a lot of people in politics, man. I mean, like your guy, Chuck Schumer. He'd never even dream of doing something like that unless a camera was there. And frankly, Pelosi and those kinds of people, they don't even think about something like that. They're beyond seeing that. They don't see the person. They just see sort of like data. But Trump actually sees the person. And he doesn't get anywhere near the credit for that kind of kindness that I saw firsthand in my own experience. And it's among the 10,000 reasons why I'm a Trumpocrat and a big fan of Donald Trump's.
You know, you mentioned this, you called it a stink that you have on you. I just have this observation. Again, years ago, before I ever thought we would have a conversation like this, I remember you kind of running around and doing these interesting things. And I just thought to myself, there's no way he's guilty. He can't, you know, I don't think he's guilty. He, number one, seems like a nice guy. Number two, if he really did it, his lawyers, you know, wouldn't let him do what he's doing. And that's what I want to kind of ask you about. I mean, maintaining a public profile while you're under indictment or you're going through that situation, that is radically different from at the time what any PR professional would probably recommend or any lawyer. That was extremely different, I believe, and creative. And again, no one in that situation other than you that I can think of, at least up until that time, did that kind of stuff. Certainly not a governor, maybe a professional wrestler. I mean, were people trying to talk you out of that kind of life for a little while? I'm sure there had to be, like, hey, you need to lay low. This is the opposite of what you should be doing.
Oh, yes, of course. And my lawyers were split. You know, I had a team of attorneys, and, you know, half of them thought it was ridiculous, you know, was not ridiculous, but they thought it was very dangerous to do that because, you know, you're up against very powerful forces. And, boy, I learned just how powerful they are and just how rigged the system is and how, you know, they have a 97% conviction rate. There's a reason why, is because the prosecutors have an ally in the courtroom. And in my case, it was the judge. He was like the fourth prosecutor. Recognizing even the risk and half the lawyers being against it, there were some lawyers who thought that it was legitimate. Either way, it wasn't going to matter. The decision was mine. It was my life, and it was what they were doing to me. I felt clearly I had no choice. I mean, what does an innocent man do when he's been maligned like that and lied like that, and he knows what the truth is, and he knows those are lies? Yes, I think the prison sentence would have been substantially lower had I not done that. You know, I got 14 years. I never took a penny. There's no evidence of that. They never even alleged that. It was 14 years for political conversations, which incidentally were all lawful, but that's a different conversation. But I got 14 years because I fought back. After they didn't convict me on the so-called corruption charges at the first trial, an 18-month number was being floated around. And it was, you know, I immediately rejected it because there was no way I was going to ever give in. And I did a lot of soul searching and a lot of thinking. And even afterwards, when I'm sitting in prison all those years and asking myself whether I did the right thing, because, you know, pride can be so much a part of the decision. And it was. And I have certain guilty feelings that maybe my pride overcame, you know, my love for my daughters, because what they've gone through and what they've had to suffer. You know, there was all kinds of talk about cutting your losses and making a deal. And I couldn't do it. I still believe I did the right thing, and I'll give you reasons why. Number one, I was innocent. And and this whole thing was all Armageddon they brought on me. It was all shock and awe. It was all designed to break my will to resist. It was psychological warfare. They came to a sitting governor's house at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was Roger Stone before it was cool to be Roger Stone. In other words, they had a SWAT team around my house. Unprecedented that they would do that to a sitting governor. Where am I going? I'm not going to run away, and I'm not a danger to the community. So they did that all by design. And they heap this on me, and then they tell the big lie, and they come up with a clever phrase, the sale of the Senate seat, just like they did with President Trump, Russian collusion. It's like they hire a Madison Avenue marketing firm to come up with these labels. It's the same playbook, by the way, that they used against me. They used against President Trump. I recognized all of it as I watched it from prison. So they do that, and they put you at a tremendous disadvantage. And everybody that you knew in politics suddenly runs away from you, and it's understandable because, well, first they're politicians. Harry Truman said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. So politicians being what they are. Secondly, in fairness to them, they don't know just about what it is that you may or may not have done. And so they're fearful because of the political firestorm that's going on. So they run away. But I knew what the truth was. And I also believe this. You know, I wasn't a businessman. Maybe in business, you look at this from a business point of view and you cut your losses and make a business decision and you suck it up and you say what they want you to say and you go away for a little while, then you come back and resume your life. I was the governor of Illinois, the land of Lincoln. I swore on the Holy Bible to protect the Constitution and the rule of law. And yes, I was doing this for my own reputation and for my children too, because I was, this is not their dad. I didn't do this. And my late parents who raised me right, that was what motivated me to fight back. But I also had a responsibility to the people, and it's offensive to me that these corrupt prosecutors, Fitzgerald, Comey, they're all connected. This guy Reed Schar, Carrie Hamilton, she's a sitting judge right now. They're corrupt. They criminalize routine practices that are legal for their own purposes and motivations. Some of it's politics, some of it's career advancement for them. They have total control, no checks and balances, and for them to hijack a governor from 13 million people in Illinois who elected him twice offended me. And then I'm thinking of all the brave men and women who've laid their lives down for our country in war, and I'm thinking about my heroes in history. What would Abraham Lincoln do? What would Teddy Roosevelt do? What would Winston Churchill do? None of them would submit. They'd fight back. So all of that kind of motivated me, plus my own natural instincts. I mean, I got some of that. So yeah. I fought back. And and frankly, I had a thing, right? I felt deep down, I felt I was a dead man. I felt like their power was so much, they could try me 10 times if they don't get me, you know, the second time. I don't have, you know, we're not wealthy. We're of modest means. And, you know, I felt like at the end of the day, I was a dead man. But even then, I felt like, you know what? I'm going to go down fighting. Because like Winston Churchill said about nations, it also applies to people. Nations that go down fighting can come back. But if you don't, there's no comeback. And I truly believe, as long and hard as it's been, frankly, I think my best days are ahead of me.
I totally agree with your best days ahead of you. I mean, that is the sense, that is the energy that I sensed when you got out of prison that night. There's a, forgive me, but I'm, there was a glow about you that night. And I think that that is true. And that's why I throw out ideas like ambassador. Who knows what is in your future, but I think it's going to be big and I think it's going to be great. And I think you deserve it. I really do. I think, and I, everything you just said about the system, it frightens me. And actually, you know what really troubles me? It doesn't really trouble me actually anymore, but I think it should be pointed out or people need to know or whatever. But the media can't stop this stuff. The media can't stop the abuse. The media are in many ways part of the problem. And, you know, I remember in your, I think in your autobiography, there was just one small thing, and they called your trip to Kosovo, Serbia, what do they call it? Blagojevich's folly. And
right.
And to
right.
me, what that underscored was they just didn't know what the hell they were talking about. I saw laziness in that headline. I saw somebody coming up with a narrative and just another example of thoughtless journalism, which is most journalism, I really believe. And there you are. You know, your story was probably, I don't know, why don't you think you're a Democrat, first of all? So, you know, you've got that going for you in terms of media relations. Why didn't the media go to bat for you? Or perhaps they did, maybe a columnist or two in Chicago. But the way I saw it, again, I was in New York and I was following these events casually. You didn't have support in the media. Or was there any, did somebody try to say, wait a second, this guy's being screwed?
That's a great question. Look, the answer is absolutely not. They were tripping all over themselves to make sure they didn't get left out of the narrative that was created cleverly by these prosecutors, who I'm certain, you know, work with, you know, public relations people, and create a public dynamic that puts the other person at an impossible situation from a public relations point of view, so that down the road, it's almost impossible to get a jury that could be fair, that hasn't been prejudiced in advance when they do these super sensational press conferences like they did the morning that I was arrested. I'm locked up, and this guy's out there lying. You know, Abraham Lincoln roll over his grave, quote unquote. We were stopping a crime spree before it happened. Well, you were stopping a crime spree before it happened, therefore it didn't happen. There's no crime. And the real history is on those tapes, which they covered up, and they went to court and got a seal order because it shows I was about to make a great deal for Illinois. And they arrested me to stop that from happening when they came at 6 in the morning the next day. But having said all of that, the media was all over that story, not at all interested in finding out the truth. I was beyond shocked that that's what happened. when they had me in custody early in that morning, and I was handcuffed, sitting in their vehicle, the governor of Illinois, handcuffed. And the head of the FBI, this guy Grant, another corrupt guy, is telling me, I said, well, what is this about? They say, well, you were trying to sell the Senate seat.
I want to jump to something. You mentioned Donald Trump, and there you are. You're the governor. You're the important one. He's the guy potentially getting kicked off the elevator. And a similar dynamic between you and Barack Obama, then State Senator Obama. One of the things that I find fascinating about him, he loses his first race for Congress in 2000. You are more accomplished politically. You're the better politician than he is. In Illinois, I mean, by any definition, you're going places. My question first is, what did you think when he lost that primary to Bobby Rush? Did you think he was finished? Did you think that was, did you see any future for him, or was that just he got knocked down, he'll get back up?
Yeah, I felt more of that. I felt he got knocked down, he'll get back up. I didn't anticipate that he'd ever be president of the United States. So that never, I didn't think that far ahead. I didn't even think at that time that he'd go on to become a U.S. senator. I thought, frankly, that Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. was the more likely United States senator from Illinois. That Jesse Jackson Jr. has a lot of political talent. He's kind of a shorter version of his father in many ways. He's articulate, he can speak very well. He has a commanding way of speaking. And I frankly thought that in a race for the Senate in 2004, because he was a congressman, if he decided to run, would have been very competitive in a Democratic primary, particularly with several candidates in the race, because the African-American candidate, the black candidate, whether it was Obama in 2004 or would have been Jackson, was going to get the lion's share of the black vote, which is a substantial vote in the Democratic primary. It makes up around 25% of the whole total primary vote. So an African-American candidate running in a field with more than, one or two other candidates, which is what happened with Obama in 2004, was in a very strong position to win the nomination and then could go on to win the general election. I always thought it was going to be Jesse Jackson Jr.
But then again, I think you said the Senate leadership, when you were considering a replacement for Obama, they had no interest in him. They shut him down right away. Do you think they had some sort of whiff about the troubles that were in his future? I mean, I think you made that quite clear that Harry Reid and Dick Durbin, that was a non-starter with them, Jesse Jackson Jr.
Yeah, that later on was the case. So in 2000 and...
Okay, it changed.
In 2000, yes, when Obama lost, Jesse Jr. was a real rising star.
All right.
And I think... certain things happened with Jesse in his life. I don't know exactly how to explain them, but, I think they got to know things about him that made them very uncomfortable with him in 2008. But they were afraid to say it.
Sure. No, that makes sense now. And the night you win, the night you are the governor-elect, the night of the election, you see Senator Barack Obama off by himself. He is kind of happy to meet you. He's congratulating you. And that is kind of wild because at that moment, he is, nobody knows it, but he's the next president of the United States. Right there at that moment, he is the next president and nobody knows it. I just love moments like that. Were you ever friends with him?
I had a good relationship with him. Friends, I wouldn't say we were that close, but I appointed a lot of people that he recommended to high positions in state government when I was governor. Agency directors, his good friend Eric Whitaker was appointed the director of public health. I put people on boards and commissions that he had recommended, had given certain of his political allies and friends good jobs in state government on his request. He would send the request through this guy named Tony Resco. I think that name is familiar to some people.
Sure.
He's the guy that bought the lot to Obama's mansion in Chicago after he'd won the Senate race. And so we had a pretty good relationship. It wasn't a close relationship, but it was good.
So we all know that you got screwed. I mean, big time. It shouldn't have happened. And if you don't mind giving me about 10 more minutes.
Yes. So take as long as you need, Greg, whatever you need. Okay.
prison. You are a former governor. You're in prison. How do the other inmates, first of all, who's in there with you? Is it medium security, low security? What kind of convicts, what kind of inmates are there? Are they bank robbers? Are they white collar people? Who did you do time with?
Yeah, there were about 900 inmates there. Drug dealers, gangbangers, drug kingpins, bank robbers. There were men there who committed murder, con artists, a lot of sex offenders. Only about 2% of the population were the so-called white-collar criminals. I think I'm the only governor ever to be in a place like that. And that's because they gave me a sentence in excess of 10 years, which I believe was on purpose. All, again, designed to break my will to resist and to give in and say the things they wanted me to say. It was among the many experiences that made up that wretched journey I was on. And, you know, you're moving up in the world in that place, because when you get yourself a prison cell of your own, it's a 6 by 8 foot prison cell, 4 cement walls, small little window with iron bars on it. The fights start. So, for example, if you see a guy put his boots on late at night, that means they're going to start fighting. If you see somebody put a lock in a sock, that means they're going to fight. And I would say the two most inflammatory circumstances where fights broke out, maybe three, would be the tremendous heat during the summer when there's no air conditioning, because there wasn't any air conditioning there. These guys would fight over the fans. And so the bigger, tougher guys would take the fan and have the fan directed on them. Somebody else might complain, and suddenly, before you know it, the two of them are going at it. And some of those fights got bloody. And then the authorities, when they learn of the fights, they're very determined to discourage it. So those guys who fight get punished, and they're put in solitary confinement for like 6 months. They fight also over the televisions, and the televisions are very political. So there's a television for the black guys, there's a television for the white guys, there's a television for the Hispanic guys. And they'll fight over the televisions when there's disagreements over the shows and things like that. And then I would say the third biggest cause of violence and of fighting would be in the weight room. But even there, it's interesting, Greg. What they did was they don't let the weights be free. They're all bolted to the ground with these chains. So you're limited in your movements with the weights, because the weights have historically been used as weapons. And the weight room was really important to many of us. And there's some guys in there. There was a guy named Sinclair. He could bench press over 700 pounds. I mean, some of these guys were, you know, big, big, tough guys. So those customs about how you fight, and then you're discouraged from breaking up the fights. And my natural instinct was always to kind of like try to break up fights. And, you know, when they beat you down like they did me, I didn't fear anything. You know, there's nothing more they could do to hurt me than what they did to me already. And nothing hurt me in there. And I didn't fear anything. And so I would periodically break fights up. And, you know, Obama, who I've known, as you know, for a long time, he gets the Nobel Peace Prize. And he didn't do anything, right? I'm sitting in prison. I'm breaking up fights between tough guys who are going at it. I mean, if anybody deserved a Nobel Peace Prize from Illinois, if it's between the two of us, it should have been me, not him.
Well, as you know, someone was watching and is watching everything at all times and keeping score. Yeah, and, you know, keeping score is possibly the wrong way to put it, but you know what I mean. And, hey, did you make any friends in jail? And by the way, it's incredible for me to think of you there. I mean, a former governor in jail with these guys, it's horrible. But I'm sure, I guess you made the best of it. But actually, most immediately, did you make friends in jail with these guys?
Yes, I did. I made several friends, actually. I can't talk to them now because I'm on probation, so I'm prohibited from doing that. But yes, very much so. In fact, I'm really doing what I can to help a friend of mine named Joan Air Moore. He's been a black guy, drug dealer, gangbanger, tough guy, heart of gold, good guy. You know, he went wrong in life because of so many disadvantages. But here's a classic case of how the 1994 crime bill that Biden wrote disproportionately discriminates against black people. This guy was given a 26-year prison sentence, never had, you know, any felony convictions before. First-time nonviolent offender, drug dealer, and they give him 26 years. He has young children. He's done more than 10 years already. He has no hope of going home. And he's, you know, gone through all of his appeals, you know, and he gets jailhouse lawyers to help him do his work because he doesn't have any money. And he's a fundamentally good person. And I met a lot of guys like him. And so, yes, I left friends behind, and some of my friends are now out, but I still can't talk to them because I'm on probation myself. But eventually, I hope to reconnect with some of those guys.
What kind of reputation did you have in prison? I mean, like, there you are. Did everybody know? And they must have known you were the former governor. I mean, and did that help you? Did that give you extra status? Did that put a target on your back? What was it? What's it like being an ex-governor in federal prison?
I think it was mostly helpful, actually. You know, I think it's really, it's less about, you know, what you were, but as opposed to who you are. And, you know, you're a member of that community, and how do you live and how do you treat your neighbors, right? And I think I was reasonably, I think, good with my neighbors. I made a lot of friends there. I mean, there were some people I didn't get along with. That's inevitable. 8 years, you're going to have conflict with people, especially when you live in close quarters like that. But I would say, by and large, the fact that I had a certain, you know, notoriety, I think, was actually a little bit of a plus for me. But there were some who, you know, think that you're, you know, that you're better than them because you were the governor. And even though I try not to act that way, and I don't think I ever did, you know, they sort of have, you know, they have a prejudice against you. So there was some of that. But I would say, by and large, it was far better the other way around. And I really got to know them. And I had a lot of friends. And my heart went out to a lot of these guys because, you know, their lives are broken. And these are guys who, unless you walk a mile in their shoes, you really never fully understand what they go through. And yes, an overwhelming number of them are guilty of the crimes they were sent to prison for. But I would say a vast majority of them were sent to prison and given sentences far longer than justice and tempered with mercy would have suggested. And they go about their business and they try to do the best they can. You got some bad guys in there. There's no doubt about it. You got some violent guys in there. There's no doubt about it. You got some real dishonest guys. There's no doubt about it. You know, I found it was interesting. I actually found, by and large, the drug dealers were more honest guys, far more honest guys than the white collar guys. I mean, a lot of those guys are just, frankly, con men and big liars. But even then, they have faults and, you know, they're not altogether evil either. But I would say most of the guys were not bad guys, some very bad guys. But I've met thousands of them because I was there for so long. I mean, 8 years, that's a long time to shelter in place in prison.
It's incredible. What did you learn any new skills? And I'm not talking about like learning about what you just talked about, you know, your fellow man and which is beautiful and important, but I'm just curious, like, did you learn any like concrete skills, like, you know, woodworking or whatever it would be, a new language? Was there anything you can point to? Okay, I learned that in jail. I'm not talking about a bigger life lesson, just some sort of concrete skill or trade or anything like that, just to pass the time.
Well, I can speak Spanish a lot better. Cuando la verdad está aliado con unos encontramos, right? I can speak Spanish a lot better. I could do a little bit before. I can do it a lot better now. I learned to play the guitar a little bit, actually, in my first year there. And that led to the formation of my band, which was called G-Rod and the Jailhouse Rockers. And we performed a GED graduation, 110 gangbangers dressed up in cap and gown for their GED graduation. And we were the music entertainment. And all the brass from the prison were there, the warden, the assistant warden, and all the others. And I was the lead singer for G-Rod and the Jailhouse Rockers. We did six songs, including an Elvis medley that included all of Don't Be Cruel, two verses of That's All Right, Mama, two verses of All Shook Up, and, of course, all the verses of Jailhouse Rock.
That's awesome. That's totally so awesome. How far before your commutation did you know that was in the works for a long time? Did it come to you rather suddenly? You know, hey, 72 hours, something might happen, or is this something that you had been working on for months, years?
Well, there was a young man named Bark Vargas who's become a dear friend, as you can imagine, for me. I owe this guy a lot. I never met him. I never knew who he was. And he came into our lives right after the Supreme Court turned down our petition to have the case heard in the Supreme Court because of the issue of where the lines are when it comes to fundraising. And suddenly he came into our lives in the spring of 2018. And my wife, Patty, kind of shed some circumstances, and Patty was fortunate to be invited the Tucker Carlson show. He was very kind to my wife. Martha McKellen was very kind to Patty. Laura Ingram was very kind to my wife, Patty. And they did, Judge Deneen Pirro was very kind to Patty. They did shows on my circumstances. And I think that sort of raised the profile. And then President Trump had periodically over that two-year period from 2018 until me finally coming home in February of 2018, would sometimes say things about me and the possibility of a commutation. So the last 2 years, Greg, were among those 8 years were the least difficult, because there's a thing in prison they call hope time. So you break your time up. And when you have a long sentence like I did 14 years, it's so far away, you can't even see the light, the flicker of a light at the end of the tunnel. So you break it up, and you break it up because you have hopes that you'll win in court, you'll win on your appeal and all the other things. And so Mark Vargas coming into our lives, and then what he was doing to get Patty out there, and President Trump's comments publicly from time to time, made the last 2 years filled with hope time. And so those years went by, and they were not good years, but they were less difficult than the preceding years that I went through. And again, I don't know, what can I say? I'm forever grateful to President Trump. He didn't have to do it. He's a Republican president. I was a Democratic governor. I think he saw wrong, and he wanted to put an end to it. And I think he may have seen parallels to what they did to me and what they were doing to him. And I would watch that too, and I would watch the unfolding of his politics. And I would recognize, for example, that when it looked like there were times where I might actually come home, that suddenly his politics was such where he correctly couldn't do it. And because I know the business, I felt like, okay, I'm going to have to wait. The hope time's going to be on hold for 6 months until the stupid Mueller's bullshit is over with. And then the following year, it looked like there was real hope that I was going to go home in August of 2019. But then there was that Ukrainian phone call, which was absolutely not only appropriate, but the president has a duty to look into the possibility that there might be criminal activity from a former vice president. And for that suddenly to be an impeachable offense, I saw that coming too.
You knew the Ukraine stuff. Yes. You knew the Ukraine anyway. Stuff was totally. All right, two more quick things. Number one, what is your priority right now? What you know, when you get up in the morning, what is your mission? Do you have full time work? Do you need full time work? Do you have something in mind? What's next, or what's happening right now?
Well, I'm very interested in something that's sort of like full time and that could help me earn a good living and do something that I think I could be good at. I've done a little bit of some consulting work, and I have a podcast, my own podcast, Greg, that I do called Lightning Rod. So that's been that you can get on Spotify and on iTunes and on WLSAM here in Chicago. So I've been doing that, but I'm certainly interested in more things. I gave a speech the other night, and I was actually paid before a Republican crowd of 50, because they're limited to 50 people because of the sheltering in place rules. And that was very good, and I really enjoyed doing that. I hope I can do more of that. But if you're asking what my priority is, I want to be the best possible father I can be to my two daughters. They've grown. My little Annie was 8 years old. She's 17 now. She was 16 when I came home. My daughter Amy was a sophomore in high school when I went away. She's now master's degree from University of Edinburgh in marketing. So I'm getting to I'm reacquainting myself with my daughters and learning who they are and working to try to be the best possible father I can be. There's plenty of room for improvement there. And I want to do the best I can, frankly, to do as well as I can to earn a good living, to build a better life for them. And then, of course, as scripture teaches us, I want to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with my God. So those are kind of what my goals are, and I feel really blessed, and I feel terrific. You know, everything's beautiful to me now. Everything around home looks great to me. Intersections in Chicago that I've known because I grew up in this city. One corner, the expressway entrance is just around the corner. There's a Popeye's chicken across the street from an IHOP. Nothing at all pretty about it, and yet to me, it looks beautiful. So everything looks so much better now that I'm home. And I don't look to the past. Winston Churchill said, if we open up a quarrel between the present and the past, we risk losing the future. You know, I don't have any hate towards anybody. My Christian faith instructs me to be forgiving. I'm working on the forgiveness part when it comes to my persecutors. I would be a liar, and I don't want to lie to God to say that I forgive them. I don't. I hope to pursue the truth and pursue justice. Eventually, maybe the full truth on what happened will come out. But I'm not obsessed with that either. I'm just, taking it one day at a time, and I'm lucky to have a chance at life again. Because what Donald Trump did for me was to bring me back from the dead and give me a chance to live again. And as I said, I'll forever be grateful to him for that.
I'm telling you, I like that guy a lot. And I think that his biggest days are ahead of him. I don't know if it's back in elective office or something on television, but he's a good man, and he got totally screwed by the system. And he's coming back, and back in a big way. And how about that, huh? Could you imagine if he tossed Donald Trump off the elevator? Oh, no, you can't be here. This is for Illinois VIPs only. He's a nice guy. And I'll wait and see what happens. All right, folks, thank you. This is the podcast, and you can check out my show on Newsmax, 7 p.m., Monday through Friday, and it reairs a couple of times during the night. So, thanks so much. Check me out on Twitter @GregKellyUSA.